Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie, and this is The Reason Podcast. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. On Sunday, November 5th, a man identified as 26-year-old Devin Kelly opened fire in a church in a small town outside of San Antonio, Texas. He killed 26 people and wounded about another 20. Today, I'm talking with Robert Verbruggen. He's the deputy managing editor of National Review and a gun policy analyst about what can be done to reduce mass shootings without eviscerating the Second Amendment. Robert, thanks for talking.
Good to be here.
As a starting point, what is your reaction as somebody who is obviously, writes a lot about crime and the reduction in violent crime over the past 25 years, but is also a staunch Second Amendment defender? What goes through your mind when news of a mass shooting, particularly one of this devastation comes across your news feed?
To me, it's always the policy analysis, I think, always has to come second when something like this happens. I think those of us who write about these issues often have this temptation to skip right to the part where it's a political football. To me, it's just, you have 26 people dead, you have a lot of children in that, and it's just, to me, that's a staggering death toll. And I think we do have to move on to the political conversation eventually. But one thing I do wish is that we would have more of at least a brief waiting period before we jump right always into the argument. And I think that goes, on both sides of the aisle too. We've had this recent argument about the hypocrisy of Donald Trump for jumping straight to immigration with the New York City attack last week. But I do think, it's a good thing for both sides to observe that and to always, keep the victims in mind when this sort of thing happens first before we start talking about the policy angle of it.
What do you think, though, when people say, of course, right-wingers, gun enthusiasts, the NRA, they always say, don't politicize this, but it's a political issue. Is it true that when you have a mass shooting, you've really got to start focusing in on gun policy, or is that actually wrong?
Well, I think we can have it both ways. I think we can have sort of a moment of silence for the victims before we discuss the policy. But I also think it's true that this brings up a lot more than just gun policy. I think right now the biggest question for me, at least in terms of gun policy, is how this guy bought a gun from a gun store. This isn't somebody who stole a gun. This isn't a guy who bought it on the black market. It's not a guy who bought from a private seller who didn't realize that he was prohibited. This is a guy who just walked into a gun store and bought a gun and passed a background check, even though he had he'd received a conviction for a domestic assault, which is supposed to ban him from that. And I very recently just read reports that he was apparently denied for a Texas concealed carry permit as well.
Right. So, and Texas is a pretty loose state for that. So if he's not getting a carry, you're right. So this is a guy who had been in the Air Force. He got a dishonorable discharge bad conduct mischarge, which was related to a domestic abuse charge against both his wife and his child. And then he was apparently convicted of domestic assault. And that is supposed to essentially create a red line for legal gun purchases. But in accounts I've read, he passed something like four gun background checks. So is that a sign that is that a sign that these background checks are useless? Is it that people in Texas or elsewhere are incredibly lax? What do you do with that kind of information?
Right now, to me, the question is how did he pass it? Why was the information not in the system when they ran the background check? Did he somehow? It doesn't seem that he used a false identity. It seems that he used his proper name and everything. To me, the big question is why wasn't this information in the background check, or if it was in the background check, did he have his rights restored? I mean, to me, the big question in terms of that is just what went wrong with this background check that somebody who only a few years before had been convicted of assaulting his wife and child, this is not supposed to happen. So to me, before we get to the rest of the discussion in terms of guns, the question is what went wrong in this specific case.
Do you have any sense of that based on your writing and research on gun issues? Is the National Gun Database, is it characteristically out of date? Is it imperfect? Do you have any sense of where this is going to end?
It's definitely imperfect. I think mental health records, especially, there's been a real problem with making sure that they're entered. But this was a decision by a military court. You would think that there'd be a straightforward process for having the military courts would turn over the records to the background check system. And I don't know why that wouldn't have happened, or how widespread that is.
Because are they supposed to? You would think that would be, very routinized, but are they obligated to turn over that in the same way that, I assume that local and state courts are?
I'm not sure if there's a legal obligation to, but it's definitely supposed to be the practice. That's what's supposed to happen, is that when disqualifying convictions are handed down, they're supposed to be entered into the system. It seems like something might have broken down there, but we don't have enough information to say exactly what happened.
What in the wake of the Las Vegas shooting, you wrote about kind of common sense. It's not common sense steps, but it's policing practices and kind of social practices that would help reduce gun violence. Talk a little bit about that, and how do you think that plays out in something like the Texas shooting?
Sure. I mean, I think It actually doesn't play out so much with the Texas shooting and with other mass shootings, because these are to me, a mass shooting is a completely different phenomenon than a run of the mill instance of violence. And so when you have policing practices, what these do, they're people based and place based approaches is what they're called. Basically, what the police do is try to get a sense of what's going on in their community, and what for example, they'll look at the geography, where do crimes tend to happen. They'll look at the people. There's actually very sophisticated statistical techniques that you can use to analyze social networks. And people have found that gun violence tends to spread through these social networks. So a lot of this is retaliation. A lot of routine gun violence is retaliation. Gangs and whatnot, and feuds, people fighting back and forth. Whereas what we have here is something a bit different, where you have somebody who snaps or is mentally ill, who just does something out of the blue that isn't expected. I've been seeing some reports that he was. He had some erratic behavior, that sort of thing, but it doesn't seem that he was involved with some sort of criminal network or something that these sorts of techniques would have picked up on. So I think they're two distinct problems that need different mm-hmm. types of solutions.
So in the first case, when you're talking about reducing what might be considered not mass shooting but gun violence that breaks out because of a gang confrontation, or in the commitment of a commission of a crime, that's really something that we saw that was championed by people like Rudy Giuliani in New York and elsewhere. The idea of using computer technology or just social media reports, even, where when there's a hotspot or where there's likely to be trouble, you flood the zone with more police and just make it more difficult for anything to happen. So that's one type. And then what do you do with mass shooting if, and I guess, that earlier version or that first sort has been pretty successful. I mean, because we have witnessed since the mid-90s really a massive reduction in the amount of violent crime in general, as well as gun-related crime in particular.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are certain aspects of that kind of approach that can help identify, so instead of looking at social networks, what you'd be looking for is new reports of people who are engaging in really erratic behavior, who have mental health issues. I mean, I think working on our approach to mental health is really important. And I have a lot of libertarian tendencies like you folks do. So I'm a little leery of making it easier to commit people. I think that's a very important, sort of civil liberties consideration. But I do think we need to look at how we're handling mental health here, which isn't to say that the specific shooter was mentally ill. I don't know that we have the evidence to say that for sure. But I think there's a definitely an individual based approach that we can make a greater effort to identify people before these things happen. Mm-hmm. And that's something we need to be looking at.
What explains, in your estimation, then, before we go on to mass shooting per se, there has been this massive decrease in gun-related crime and gun-related violence. What explains that? How much of it is attributable to, say, new policing techniques? How much to, more guns, the proliferation of guns in circulation, kind of the more guns, less crime thesis? basis, or what, you know, or is there something more general that we're missing, or is it largely, you know, it's not something we can really account for?
I mean, there are some things we can account for. You know, there've been changing demographics. Certainly better policing has contributed to it. But this is something that criminologists really have not nailed down yet. There was a big debate that kind of came back maybe a year or two ago, and the Brennan Center had its report where they had, you know, tried to attach some percentages to different things. I just think it's a lot of different factors. There's demographics, there's better policing practices. An interesting theory is that the removal of lead from paint, mm-hmm. You know, had an effect on that. The Brennan folks weren't very convinced by that, but I think there's sort of a growing amount of
And the idea behind that is that that lead actually disinhibited a lot of antisocial behavior as well as impulse control. And we used to, I mean, I know this from stories I've written in the past, the average kid in 1965 had a level of lead in their blood, which was higher than what would trigger an alert now for remediation. So there's been a real sea change between, you mentioned lead paint, also getting rid of unleaded gasoline has drastically reduced the amount of environmental lead. Demographics, what do you mean by that?
We're just in an aging society. So we have old people commit less crime than younger people. So your per capita rate of crime is going to go down as your population starts skewing older. And I don't think that's a huge contributor, but it's one thing that's...
Do you buy the idea that, you know, that having more guns in circulation actually reduces overall violence? And this goes back to the kind of Robert Heinlein. It's attributed, the phrase is sometimes attributed to Robert Heinlein, sometimes to William Burroughs, but the idea that a armed society is a pleasant society. And even though, so there are more guns in circulation, they actually seem to be owned by a slightly smaller percentage than 20 or 30 years ago. But the idea is that if criminals who respond at least to basic kind of reward incentive structures, if they're not sure if the person they're attacking is packing heat, they're less likely to act on an impulse towards violence.
That's a question that I've spent far too much of my life reading studies about, and I wish I had a better answer for you, but I'm just not really convinced either way on that. The studies people point to that suggest that, you know, higher gun ownership or concealed carry laws increase crime don't really convince me. But the, you know, the other side of it doesn't necessarily convince me either. I think it's a very difficult topic to study just because there's just so much else going on that you need to sort of account for in your studies, and we don't have good statistical techniques that, you know, sort of pull all of that apart to really show us what's going on. Certainly I'll say that, you know, we do have a lot more guns in circulation now than we used to, and crime has gone down. So I think that definitely.
So, I mean, there's at least a correlation. I mean, and one of the things that when the assault weapons ban expired years ago, and when states really started liberalizing their gun laws in significant ways, a lot of people predicted the more guns that go into private ownership, you're going to see increases in crime. The one thing that we can say, you know, at least in terms of correlation so far, is that has not happened. And in fact, the reverse happened, right?
Right. I mean, it's just this idea that putting more guns out there, that passing concealed carry laws is just going to cause this instant avalanche of people shooting each other after car accidents and so on and so forth. That just hasn't happened. And I think that's important. I think that's something that a lot of people on the left, I don't think, face up to.
Yeah. So, let's talk about mass shootings. I'm looking right now at a chart that was published in Politico not long ago that charts mass shootings from the early 80s through 2016. This article came out just a few months ago. And it says mass shootings are not getting more common, but they are getting more deadly. Does that square with your sense of things?
That does square with my sense of it. The one thing I would note is that there's a whole lot of debate over what constitutes a mass shooting. I know the folks at I think it's called the Gun Violence Archive. If you include basically any kind of situation where, you know, there's a gang dispute and somebody, you know, sprays some bullets into the, you know, a party of the opposing gang and wounds a few people, that's a mass shooting. You know, they're saying that there are hundreds of mass shootings a year, versus what we normally think of it, you know, sort of a spree killing. They're just completely, you can generate such a wide range of estimates that I think it's fairly difficult to measure trends. But certainly the most deadly ones have been happening with much more frequency, and I don't know why that is.
Well, is it critics of gun rights would say that it's because we're allowing military style weapons, and sometimes they use the old and imprecise term assault weapons. Other times they say military type weapons. But is it because of the proliferation of semi-automatic rifles and handguns, which allow people to shoot with more force and pretty quickly?
I don't think that the two trends track each other well enough. I mean, semi-automatic guns really started to spread, I think, in the 80s and 90s. We don't have great data on the types of guns people own at each point in time. And then there was the assault weapon ban from 94 to 2004. But the big uptick in the really deadly ones, to me, seems to have been more the past 5 years or so. So, I mean, I'm not sure that the trends track each other well enough for that to be the cause. I don't know if it's something cultural or what's going on, but it's definitely alarming that we've had, two of the most deadly mass shootings of the past, 50 years or so, just in the past couple of months.
Right. And people are talking about the church shooting and this, you start to get into these narrow cast kind of niches, but that this is the deadliest church shooting in American history, or at least in recorded American history. What do you have any sense? I mean, you say maybe it's a cultural thing. What does that mean? Do you have any way of making sense of why there are more deadly mass shootings, in the past 5 years or so?
Yeah, I just don't know. I mean, the thing is, even though they're growing more frequent, they're just so few in number that I don't think you can have a really good sense of the patterns there. Because it's not that we have guns now, but we didn't have guns 10 years ago. It's not that we have mentally ill people, but we didn't have mentally ill people 10 years ago. It's just, I'm not sure what has changed recently that would have caused this.
Some people on the, typically on the left, or people who are against gun rights, will point out that overwhelmingly mass shooters tend to be white males. That also has not changed, right? So it is difficult to come up with any kind of variable that might, kind of explain why mass shootings, if they are not getting more numerous or more frequent, are getting more deadly. Let's talk about, are there policies that could reduce the, either the number or the deadliness of mass shootings? What can be done, if anything, that doesn't, directly erode Second Amendment rights?
To me, the biggest thing in terms of mass shootings, I think it's a very difficult problem. I think most of the policies that people put out there are probably not going to have very much of a difference. But if I had to pick one that might, I think it's just making a better effort to deal with mental illness, because a lot of these folks have severe mental illness, and we've not done a very good job of identifying people who are severely mentally ill and need help. So that would be my number one suggestion.
So talk, what does that mean? Does that mean that when you apply for, to buy a gun, that your mental health records are available to a gun store vendor? Or is it that is it outside of the purview of anything related to purchasing guns? What does it mean to be? I mean, and obviously, depending on how you define mental illness, there's either an uptick in that, everybody is on some kind of antidepressant these days, or some other kind of psychopharmaceutical. But is that what's driving this type of thing?
I think it's both. I mean, it's already supposed to be the case that if you have history of being institutionalized, that information is supposed to be in the background check system, and it's too often not. So that's one element of it. But from talking to people who specialize in this and understand mental illness policy, there's been going back decades now, we've taken a more hands off approach to it, and a lot of people are saying that the pendulum has swung too far to the civil liberties side, where we're not intervening to help people who need it. And I think that's something that we have to look at really hard and really carefully, both to control these things and to make sure that we don't go too far back in the other direction.
Right. Because there's still, I mean, the the kind of pushback against making it extremely easy to institutionalize somebody was, you know, there was a reason people were offended by that. And there's still something on the order of a million involuntary institutionalizations a year in America. But I mean, that does raise certain civil liberties issues, right? Where if you say anybody who has, you know, done certain things or has had certain issues in the past, that they lose a constitutional right, that's, I mean, you really need to have a pretty bright line there, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the inherent difficulty, is that you need to have a bright line, but I'm not sure it's possible to draw a line that's bright and will satisfy everybody who's concerned about this. I think it's just something that we have to spend a lot more time studying and looking at the current system and seeing how we can improve it.
Is there any reason to be worried that guns that are purchased illegally are a major contributor to mass shootings?
I haven't seen a complete breakdown, but if you look at the most recent ones, certainly they've been overwhelmingly just people who walked into gun stores and bought them. And you've seen people passing background checks. So that in terms of the mass shooting problem, as opposed to the sort of more general gun violence problem in this country, it doesn't seem to be that these are folks who are getting guns only because there's this, you know, private sale loophole where you can buy a gun from another individual without passing a background check.
Mm-hmm. How does this play out politically? Is there between Vegas, which was massively, deadly, and this incident, which, you know, because it's at a church, it really puts in relief, you know, the horror of this kind of incident. Do you think politically something will be done to at least cosmetically address these issues, or do you think that that's really not likely to happen?
I don't think we're going to see anything more than a cosmetic attempt to deal with this. Back when Las Vegas happened, I really thought that there was a very good chance we were going to see some sort of action on, you know, bump stocks, basically the attachment the shooter used that makes a semi-automatic rifle fire almost as quickly as a fully automatic one. And even on that, Congress has sort of refused to do anything so far. They tried to punt it to the ATF, even though, in my view, the law doesn't allow the ATF to do anything about this. The wording of the law does not permit the ATF to make a decision on whether bump stocks are legal. That has to be done by Congress. So, I mean, to me, that was sort of a sign that, you know, we're not going to see any sort of gun control. I mean, which isn't shocking because it's a Republican Congress, but I mean, their refusal to even do a fairly minor thing like that a lot of Republicans have said that we should do, indicated to me that nothing's going to happen there. I mean, in terms of the other kinds of measures, like, you know, we were talking about mental health, that might be a better chance, depending on how this turns out. The actual shooter in this case.
In mass shooting stories, how long does it take for a kind of fuller picture to become clear? And I'm thinking back to, incidents like Columbine from the late 90s, where there was a very clear image of who the shooters were and what their motivations were, that they were kids who had been bullied and picked on, that they were outcasts, that they had played violent video games and listened to certain types of music and watched certain types of TV. You know, that came out very quickly, and then it was essentially completely deconstructed, although it lingers on in the public imagination with other issues. I mean, for instance, the Vegas shooting, we really don't have much more information about the shooter than we did when it happened, other than that he was people around him said he was depressed and he had suffered a fair amount of gambling losses. But is there a typical pattern that it takes or a period of time that it takes for information to come out that at least clarifies the motives of people as well as the actions, things like you were talking about, like how did he get through these background checks when he should have clearly been disqualified?
I think when it comes to the basic facts, there's usually a period of a few days where there's a lot of confusion and a lot of bad reporting, and that tends to get cleared up relatively quickly in the first week or so. When it comes to motives, though, I mean, it really depends on the shooting, how clear it even was, what the motive was. And also, I mean, I think Columbine, it's interesting to think back to that, you know, almost 20 years later. just how wrong that was something that was sustained for months and months, this narrative of who these kids were before it gradually fell apart. So to me, it just depends on the individual situation rather than, you know, being a concrete time frame for how long it takes to know what happened.
Do you feel, when you think about courts looking at gun legislation and or cases that either challenge or support gun rights, do you worry that the Supreme Court or, you know, at various levels, that state and federal judges read the newspapers and that they feel a desire similar to politicians to do something that might be completely at odds either with sound jurisprudence or, you know, the long-term trends towards a less violent America?
I think that's true. I think, you know, judges are human beings. A lot of times they have political views and pressures that we wish they would set aside, but they may be compelled to do that. I mean, I think, you know, judicial activism is a real problem with the court system, all the way up to the Supreme Court, something that I think conservatives and libertarians alike have some concerns with.
Do you, Donald Trump is, you know, in somebody, National Review, your publication, you know, famously came out against Donald Trump running for president. And since then, you know, I mean, they're among conservatives. You know, some people have kind of gotten behind him. I think National Review remains, you know, pretty critical of Donald Trump. And one of the reasons or one of the arguments is that he wasn't really a true conservative or even a true Republican. Certainly in the past, he's said, you know, wildly different things about gun control, whether he's for it or against it. Obviously, running as a Republican and winning the presidency, he was you know, he was very pro-Second Amendment. Do you have any fear that incidents like this, however atypical, but, you know, they're extremely highly publicized and he's shown a propensity for breaking with Republicans if he can get what he wants from Democrats. Do you worry that Donald Trump will, you know, will become less ardent a supporter of the Second Amendment?
I haven't seen any sign of that so far, but I share the National Review editorial board's skepticism of the guy. So I wouldn't, if his calculation someday is that flipping on this issue would be advantageous to him, I don't doubt that he would do it.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you, Robert Verbruggen of National Review, for talking to Reason about the Texas church shooting and the likely aftermath of that.
Thank you so much.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I'm Nick Gillespie. Thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there.